Hello, I'm Sir Dudley Biddley Haversham Sedgwick Smythe, Peter's imaginary synthesized personal manservant. This is number 0516, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0516. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, historian David O'Keefe, author of 7 Days in Hell, the story of a bloody World War II battle that was lost in the shadow of D-Day.
Most of the historiography and most of the press goes to the first day of the Normandy campaign, which of course is D-Day. But this took place about 6 weeks into the campaign, and it turned out to be the bloodiest day for the Canadian Army next to Dieppe, the big tragedy in 1942.
Broadcaster and author Tommy Schnurmacher on his book, Mom's Makeup Tips from Auschwitz. How Vanity Saved My Mother's Life.
My mother is also a very beautiful woman and a very vain woman. And when she got to Auschwitz, she decided that she didn't like the outfit that they gave her. So she traded her daily ration of bread for needle and thread and sewed the outfit so that it fits better. She didn't use the swill that they gave them as coffee. Instead of drinking it, she used it to polish her shoes because her father had bought her some shoes just before the holidays, before she was deported. So she cleaned up the shoes as well. And in the morning roll called one of the female commandants of Auschwitz, faster to come out of the lineup and said, "What's a Jew looking so clean in a place like this?"
Lynn Matsuoka, artist and author of the adult coloring book, Saving Our Endangered Seabirds.
I think a lot of people know that the coloring books help you de-stress and separate you from the terrible wheel you're on every day. And that my book affords you. But the major thing about this book is I have some wonderful guest pages where people like Susan Rockefeller and other PhDs and doctors of science have written very moving and informative messages about how climate change is affecting us and that we have to get off our duff and do something.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0516 was Sir Dudley Piddley Haversham Sedgwick Smythe, my synthesized personal manservant. And now that he can also do voice work, we'll all soon be out of a job. Yeah. Thank you very much, Sir Dudley, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? So, how much cash do you think you can cram up your butt? $50? Maybe $100? What if you were really motivated, like it was your entire cachet and it was about to be confiscated by the police? Let's ask 30-year-old Tyrone Booker, shall we? Tyrone was arrested during a drug sting in Jacksonville, Florida. According to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, Booker was placed in the back seat of a cruiser. An officer observed about $300 in the suspect's wallet. The officer then walked away. When he returned, the money was missing. Booker said an undercover officer took the money. Officers searched the vehicle, but the money wasn't found. Once at the jail, the arresting officer then looked at the footage from the cruiser camera. The video showed Booker spitting on his hands to lubricate his fingers and repeatedly putting his hands in the back of his pants. Officers then performed a strip search and found nothing. The suspect finally revealed his hiding spot when he found out that the next step was a trip to the emergency room. The money was rolled up and wrapped in a rubber band inside his rectum. Due to the money being covered in what the sheriff's office euphemistically called a biohazard, it was not counted and the funds could not be verified. Booker is facing charges of resisting an officer, introducing or smuggling contraband into a detention facility, tampering with evidence, and selling marijuana. You know, when I consider what's happened here, this is not the usual dictionary definition of tampering that I'm familiar with. Okay, little Sebastian Swenson of Blaine, Minnesota, wanted Reese's candy, and he wanted it now. So, on the morning of June 11th, the four-year-old climbed into the front seat of his great-grandfather's Hyundai Santa Fe and drove at low speeds to a nearby gas station, where police met him. To accomplish this, he had to reverse out of the driveway and navigate winding residential streets before getting onto a busy four-lane avenue in rush hour traffic. Along the way, he dinged a few mailboxes and a tree, but he arrived safe and sound. Blaine Police Captain Mark Borboom said, "I've never seen a driver this young before operating a vehicle." Yeah. You know, this kid is going to be a handful by the time he's 10, and imagine what he's like on a sugar rush. Now, on the other end of the driving scale, in Rybnik, Poland, a 68-year-old woman who was completing the maneuvers part of her driving exam struck and killed a 35-year-old driving examiner on June 24th. Police believe the victim was testing another candidate at the time. The deputy police commissioner said it was unknown how the accident happened. The woman was in a total shock afterward, and because of that, speaking to her would be quite difficult. I'm going out on a limb to say that she's probably not getting her license. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Texas woman was banned from her local Walmart after police say she ate half a cake and refused to pay for the missing portion. Wichita Falls police were called to a Walmart just after 8 p.m. after receiving calls that a woman walked around the store eating half of a cake and refusing to pay for the whole item, saying she was only paying for the remaining half because that's the way she found it. The suspect, who had not been identified, entered the bakery section of the store and proceeded to eat half of the cake while walking through the aisles. Once at the register, the woman demanded half off because she was only buying half of a cake. Police say she refused to pay for the missing half of the cake despite eating it on the way to the checkout. She ultimately paid for the whole cake once police arrived, and she was eventually barred from the store for theft.
Save money, live better. Walmart.
By the way, this isn't the first time we've mentioned a Walmart store in Wichita Falls. If you remember, earlier this year, there was another woman who was banned from a Walmart in the Wichita Falls area after police say she rode around the parking lot in an electric cart while drinking wine from a Pringles can. Wow. Walmart is like the Star Wars bar. Back to the woman with the cake for a moment. Think about it. This was a full-size cake. She ate half of it. Please tell me that this isn't normal to eat half a cake in one sitting. Please. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Historian David O'Keefe is back on the program. That's because he has a new book out. It's called 7 Days in Hell, and it tells the epic story of the men from the Black Watch during a bloody World War II battle. In addition to being a history professor, David is also a television producer and documentarian. He joins us via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Pete. How are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. This particular battle, the one that you depict in the book, 7 Days in Hell, it's not one of the well-known battles, and I guess it's kind of overshadowed by D-Day itself. Would that be correct?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, most of the historiography and most of the press goes to the first day of the Normandy campaign, which, of course, is D-Day. But this took place about 6 weeks into the campaign, and it turned out to be the bloodiest day for the Canadian Army next to Dieppe, the big tragedy in 1942.
Okay, so tell us about this particular battle, where it was, and who was involved, because it was not just Canadians.
No, not at all. I mean, as a matter of fact, it's a Canadian operation led by the 2nd Canadian Corps, but it also had British units in it, the 7th Armored Division and the Guards Armored Division. And it was a battle essentially for Verrières Ridge. And the way that the Canadian High Command viewed it, particularly the general who led it, General Guy Simmons, was this had an opportunity of being his Vimy Ridge of the Second World War. And they were taking on, it was fought at a little place south of Caen, which is the big capital of Normandy. And it's a ridge line that runs about 7 kilometers south. And it was tactically and strategically dominating ground. And the Germans had basically set up their entire defense for the eastern part of Normandy along this ridge over the couple of days leading up to the battle. So basically, it was a race for time to be able to get the ridge or wrestle the ridge from German hands before they fortified it and would make it even more costly.
When generals plan battles and set out what they're going to do in any particular campaign, they kind of assess what casualties are going to be like and how successful they would be. Was this particular battle as successful as they wanted it to be, worse or better?
No, this turned out to be, sadly, an unmitigated failure. They really hoped that they would be able to draw the Germans into a nasty battle of attrition, where at the end of the day, they'd be able to use their overwhelming superiority, numerical superiority in tanks and aircraft and artillery to destroy the German panzers. But sadly, things went off the rails almost immediately, and as a result, it was the Germans who turned the tables on the Canadians.
Was it a domino effect? Like, what went off the rails, and did that lead to other things going off the rails?
Well, yeah, it's kind of both, actually. The plan, right from the start, was not a very good one. It was a plan that was basically war by timetable. So General Simmons had a very tight control over it. He was a real micromanager, and he made sure that everything was scripted. So that the people on the ground who were actually fighting at the sharp end, who could see the events that were unfolding in front of them, really had little initiative on the day. So when a couple of units ended up getting behind time and there were casualties that people didn't expect, and the Germans, of course, reinforced the area, his plan started to collapse right at the beginning, and it just spiraled downhill throughout the day.
When it comes to looking back at it from a historical point of view, we tend to spend a lot of time looking at our successes as a nation when it comes to battles, but not necessarily things that didn't go as well as they should have. Is it difficult finding information to write a book like 7 Days in Hell, because we tend to look at the other battles, especially considering there were so many big battles just before it with D-Day?
Well, in some ways it is, but you have to realize that we've been blessed in Canada. We had an incredible army historian by the name of C.P. Stacey, and he had a whole team of historians that traveled with the Canadian forces. And although he was indeed under army command and subject to all the chain of command that you would expect, he was very good. He was number one a historian before he was an army officer. And what he used to do was, even though he couldn't report or write about something at the time, he would note it down and leave it for future generations of historians to use. And of course, I benefited from that. So I've been able to go in and, for instance, take a look at what General Simmons, who at the end of the battle realized it was such a disaster and tried immediately to massage the story. So in other words, put his own spin on events and downplay the massive casualties that his corps took under his command based on his plan. So as a result, you would think it would be very difficult to get your hands on this material, but because of the incredible work of Stacey, who was truly dedicated to his craft, there has been a lot that was left for, like I said, future generations like myself to use.
Percentage-wise, how many did we lose in that battle?
Well, this was the second bloodiest day next to Dieppe, and in the Second World War for Canadian soldiers. We lost 1,500 men on that day, and about 500 were fatal. So we lost 500 men in about 6 hours of combat. And for my book, I've concentrated on the unit that that suffered the heaviest casualties, and that was the Black Watch from Montreal, who out of those 500 men who died, 126 came from the Black Watch.
Wow. And of the numbers, what were the total numbers of Black Watch members who went?
Well, the Black Watch, when they made their fateful assault on July 25th, 1944, they started moving up the slope of Verrieres Ridge with 320 men. And 24 hours later, only 20 men were fit for duty. The rest were killed, wounded, or missing, or in German hands.
Wow. So in doing a book like this, I mean, you talk about, obviously, you've talked about how you've had a lot to work with and work from for your book. Is there any firsthand accounts? I mean, first of all, we're way past that time now, so the chances of somebody being alive are slim, but even slimmer with a smaller group to start with.
Well, you're absolutely right. Luckily, for the survivors, the ones who ended up in German hands, when they came back, they were interviewed by Stacy's historical team. Some of them, the survivors who actually made it out that day, were interviewed around the time as well. But I started the research for this back in the early 90s. So I was able to sit down with a few of the men who sadly are all gone now, and I was able to get their stories. Now, of course, I'm getting their stories, you know, 50 years after the fact, but at least their stories were recorded before they passed on. So it's a mixture of contemporary archives. So, for instance, war diaries, message logs, things that were, you know, created at the time. Plus, of course, the interviews that I did in the early 90s and any of the other material that was left over.
You've done several books now. How do you go about choosing the topics that you want to do a book on? How did you go about choosing this particular battle for 7 days in Hell?
Well, I think partly it's mystery. I think it really is just righting the wrongs of the past and making sure that there's a true understanding of what happened on a particular day. I guess one of the most objectionable parts of this whole episode was that at the end of the war, when Simmons was asked to account for what happened, he decided he was going to blame it on those who died and who could not answer back. So as a historian, that kind of stuck in my craw, and I decided that I was going to investigate it and see exactly what the truth was behind this and kind of give voice back to people who lost it many, many years ago. So that's kind of what drives me for these things.
Has it gotten easier for you as time goes on? Because you do have, pardon the pun, a little bit of history in the fact that you've written several books, you've done television shows. Are people more open to having you tell their story or their ancestors' story because you have been successful in telling these stories in the past?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. It becomes a snowball effect. You know, you can, you know, when you call somebody up and you explain who you are and they clue in, usually the floodgates open. As a matter of fact, I've had cooperation from many of the families in writing this book, and I've been able to get my hands on letters that were written at the time before, you know, some of these men were killed. You know, a lot of emotional stuff, and also, too, you know, the stories that they knew about their families. And also, they've opened up, too. You know, some of the men that I've focused on, we're not all saints. And so as a result, there were some painful chapters and painful moments that do come up in the book. And a lot of that was provided by the families. And I guess after, you know, working on this for so many years and developing the reputation that I have in the field, there's a certain amount of trust that, you know, the families or the participants will have. And it does make my job a lot easier. But I think more importantly, it makes the history a lot richer.
You mentioned the men who went off to these battles, but in doing what you do, from our perspective as a society, when you look back at these, especially if you see the family letters, they're just kids, aren't they?
Oh, God, were they ever. The average age of the men who went up Verrieres Ridge was about, when I say men, 22 or 23. So essentially a graduating university class. And it's remarkable because even though that was the average, you know, there was a significant amount of them that were 18 or 19. I mean, these are the age of my students that I teach at in college. So it's kind of, you know, it's strange when I walk into the classroom and take a look at my class and realize, okay, you could have been a platoon with the Black Watch at Verrieres. That is striking. That really puts things into context. And of course, reading the letters not only, you know, from the men themselves back home, but from, you know, to their mothers, because most of them weren't married. You know, it was their mother and father or brother and sister that they were corresponding with. And then, of course, going through their personnel files, you see probably the saddest artifact you could ever find, which is, of course, the telegram home that, you know, that broke the news that they'd been killed in battle.
Wow. Another fascinating story. The book is 7 Days in Hell. David, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure, Peter. Anytime.
Military historian David O'Keefe, author of 7 Days in Hell. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0516, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can pre-order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Tommy Schnurmacher, the author of Mom's Makeup Tips from Auschwitz, How Vanity Saved My Mother's Life, and artist and author Lynn Matsuoka with her book, Saving Our Endangered Seabirds. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcast and Apple Podcast. Just click on the Google Podcast or Apple Podcast button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. A Michigan man who claimed to be a resident on the planet Zoltron is facing a number of charges after he allegedly attacked a Muskegon County Sheriff deputy's cruiser with a 4-foot metal pipe. Officers were investigating reports about a man breaking into homes when they came across Calquan Dion Burr. On the dash camera video, Burr can be seen charging the cruiser, jumping on the hood of the car, and attacking the windshield. Said Lieutenant Shane Brown of the Muskegon County Sheriff's Department, the officers round the corner and the guy is already running at the car. Officers almost had zero time to respond, and there was no time to avoid him. While the 20-year-old was being arrested, he told police that he could have tackled the car and could have crushed it if he wanted to. He also claimed he was from the planet Zoltron and that his father sent him. Burr appeared to be on some sort of mind-altering drug, and a witness said that he seemed drunk or high and was talking about seeing blue orbits. The suspect was charged with malicious destruction of property, damaging police property, assault, and other charges. Well, he's allowed one phone call in prison. I guess he'll call his father. Anybody know the area code for Zoltron? By the way, if you want to see the dash cam video of this encounter, it's on the Stuff File program fan page on Facebook. Okay, a man smashed through the window of the King County Sheriff's Office substation in Fairwood, a small community near Renton, Washington, that was unoccupied at the time. Once inside, he made himself comfortable. He parked himself in a room deputies used to write reports, put his feet up, lit a cigar, and waited. When deputies arrived, the man said he chose the substation to wait because it would be better to go to jail than to, quote, kill his roommate. But he didn't come empty-handed. Fearing deputies would be mad at him for the break-in, the suspect brought along a peace offering, a fresh box of donuts. The unnamed 26-year-old man was booked into jail for malicious mischief and trespassing. A police spokesman noted the fate of the donuts was not known. Well, would you eat a donut offered by someone who admitted being murderous? I mean, seriously. A Kansas homeowner woke up to the sounds of a burglar in his basement, but there weren't the sounds of breaking glass or moving objects. The homeowner reportedly heard the burglar yelling for help from the basement after he strapped himself to an inversion table and could not free himself. The burglar reportedly told the homeowner, "They told me to come here," when asked what he was doing in the home. Once he was freed from the table, Jeremy Saunders was taken to a hospital to be checked for drug use. He was then taken to Saline County Jail and charged with aggravated burglary for taking cranberry juice from the man's home. You know, they should have just kept him on the inversion table. You know, and not give him a heads up. Literally. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an Indian man who had been declared dead woke up just before he was set to be buried during a funeral ceremony. 20-year-old Mohammed Furkan was declared dead by Indian medical professionals, but his surprise awakening at the funeral shocked mourners. He was immediately brought to the hospital and put on a ventilator to support him. Mohammed had been unconscious since June 21st, when he got into an accident. Doctors declared him dead on Monday, but coincidentally only after the man's family told the hospital they no longer had the funds to pay for his care. The family said the situation left them traumatized because they not only had to come to terms with Muhammad's passing, but then to see him move during the funeral. Said an older brother, devastated, "We were preparing for the burial when some of us saw movement in his limbs. We immediately took him to another hospital where the doctors said he was alive and have put him on a ventilator support." The family had paid the equivalent of $10,000 to a private hospital earlier, and when they told them that they had run out of money, they declared Mohammed dead. The city's chief medical officer says an investigation is underway into the country's medical practices. The patient is in critical condition, but definitely not brain dead. He has a pulse, blood pressure, and his reflexes are working. Well, thank God I live in a place with socialized medicine. I can't decide whether this is a story of greed or incompetence. This is why some doctors who aren't so sure of themselves decide to become medical examiners and work only on the dead. If they screw up on their job completely, the worst thing that could possibly happen to their patient is they develop a pulse. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Legendary Montreal broadcaster and raconteur Tommy Schnurmacher has written a memoir with a most interesting title. It's called Mom's Makeup Tips from Auschwitz, How Vanity Saved My Mother's Life. Tommy joins us now on the line from right here in Montreal. Hi, Tommy.
Hi. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. Good to talk to you once again. You wrote this book not only with an interesting title, but you also wrote it in an interesting way. You kind of fed it to an audience over a period of time via Facebook. How did this idea come up?
This is how it all happened. Many, many years ago, back at CJD in Montreal, I would tell Gord Sinclair funny stories about my family. And he said, you know, one of these days, you're going to have to write a book about it. And I put that in the back of my mind, and I didn't do it for a while. And then I decided it was time to write a memoir. My mother had a very interesting story about how she survived the Holocaust. So I started writing the book, and then what happened is I became a procrastinator. I kept delaying, postponing it. Like, you know, I was busy doing all kinds of other things other than sitting down and writing the book. So one day I was at the Argo bookstore. They've on St. Catherine Street. They've got a tiny little room in the back that you can rent for $3 an hour and just sit and relax and read or write. And in that room, I had an epiphany in that what any work that I've ever done in my life, when I wrote the column for the Gazette, when I was at CJD, I needed a deadline, a firm, solid deadline set by somebody else, not set by me. So I figured what I'm going to do is I'm going to vow to put up a chapter a day on Facebook by noon every day. And so I posted that on Facebook. And so as the day wore on, I knew by noon it had to be done. So I'd start the day before to make sure it was done. And in the morning, I'd touch it up. So by noon, I could hit the post button. There it was. And I'd have a tease at the end, and then that was on Monday. Then I did it on Tuesday. I kept repeating it for, I believe, about 5 or 6 weeks in a row. And the reaction was phenomenal. People really loved it. They're very enthusiastic about it. They couldn't wait to hear about the next one, the next one. When's the next chapter? When's the next chapter? Now, this was like Costco, right? It's one thing to give samples, but I'm not going to give away the whole roast. So I did that for about 25 chapters, and then I stopped doing it. The rest I did on my own, and the way I managed to keep procrastination at bay the second time, like after I finished with Facebook, what I did, Peter, is I wrote a check in U.S. funds made out to the reelect Donald Trump committee. I put this check into an envelope and gave it to a friend with instructions that unless she saw a chapter a day written by noon, she had instructions to mail the check. I can reassure you now that the check was never mailed. I continued writing the book in that manner. I finished the book. I had it edited by someone in England. I'm putting the finishing touches to the editing now. And the book should be released on November the 19th, 2019. And right now, I think at this point, the only place taking pre-order, Paragraph Bookstore on McGill College, is taking pre-orders.
Now, I've worked with you for many years, many, many years. I was lucky enough to also meet your mom and other members other members of your family. Your mom was quite a character, I have to agree. You got her to talk about stuff before when it came about her days, surviving the Holocaust. And your mom was willing to talk about this when a lot of people, quite frankly, were not willing to talk about their experiences. What made your mother so open about the situation?
Well, I think it was, I asked a lot of questions, like I wanted to know why other kids had grandparents and I didn't. And I wanted to know why mom had a blue tattoo on her arm of the letter A and then five numerals afterwards. I wanted to know about that. And my mother had a great sense of humor. And she said, well, you know, it's not a phone number. This is how the Nazis kept track of their Jews. And then when she'd talk about her parents, she'd cry because she would tell me what happened to them, that they, you know, were carted off in cattle cars and shipped to Auschwitz and they're gassed to death in Auschwitz. So she told me all of these stories. But one of the stories that really struck me, because I kept asking, well, tell me what happened every day, like what happened that in the morning, what happened in the afternoon. I wanted to get as much detail as I possibly could. And my mother, as if you remember, was also she's a very beautiful woman and a very vain woman. And when she got to Auschwitz, she decided that she didn't like the outfit that they gave her. She didn't fit very well. So she traded her daily ration of bread for needle and thread and sewed the outfit so that it fit better. It fit more snugly. She didn't use this swill that they gave them as coffee. Instead of drinking it, she used it to polish her shoes because her father had bought her some shoes just before the holidays, the Shavuot holidays, before she was deported. So she cleaned up the shoes as well. And in the morning roll call, this woman, Irma Greza, one of the female commandants of Auschwitz, in the lineup, asked her to come out of the lineup and said, what's a Jew looking so clean in a place like this? And my mother told her exactly what she had done. And Greza, on who they patterned the character Irma, She-Wolf of the SS, this woman Greza said, well, in that case, if you're so clean, then you could work as my valet. She became her personal ballet, you know, cleaning her shoes and her boots and tending to her garden. And that is how she managed to survive Auschwitz.
Wow. Now, your mom is no longer with us, unfortunately, but how would she feel about this book being written?
Well, she'd sit around, often when I'd be writing the book, she'd come by and visit. We lived in the same apartment building. She lived on a 12th floor. I lived on the third floor. And she'd come in and say, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing a book." "So what are you writing? Are you going to write about me?" I said, "You bet I'm going to write about you." And she said, "What are you going to write about me? There's nothing you can write about me." I said, "There's plenty I can write about you." And I did. And like when she'd talk, as slowly she had a certain level of early dementia, which I didn't believe in and I denied. There's a lot of in the book about how to deal with a parent with dementia. But she had a sense of humor throughout. And one of the, when she sort of be talking to herself and muttering to herself and saying things to herself, I would take that all down and some of it would end up in the book. But she managed to retain a sense of humor all the time. And what was intriguing, how she kept that sense of humor despite the tragedy she went through in Auschwitz and in Budapest. So I think she's pretty happy about the fact that I wrote the book about her.
She was always a funny lady. Do you think you got your sense of humor from her?
No, actually, no. My father was even more hilarious. He had the sense. She was my mother was like a wacky character. She was an eccentric character. But the actual sense of humor is directly for the cynicism, the sarcasm, the funny, that's all from my father. Mm.
So now that you've written this book, you say it comes out in November, you did write several chapters that are on Facebook. For people listening to this right now who haven't read any of it, are those first chapters still up there?
I don't know if they pop up every now and then here and there on Facebook, but if people want to sample some of it, the easiest way to do it is to go to my website, talkradiotommy.com, right. And there's several sample chapters that are up there.
And now that you've written the book and now that you're retired from CJD, how are you keeping busy?
Well, I'm busy with the book and with the marketing of the book and with a podcast called Spirits and Spirituality, which I do with a Rabbi Avi Feingold. We interview interesting guests like David Frum and Nathan Englander, novelists. What we do is we do it over drinks. We have, hence the spirits. And when we have a few of the spirits, then we talk about the spirituality. So I'm busy with the podcast. It's now in its, that's in its second season. So that and writing the book, and I'm getting a lot of speaking engagements. People ask me to speak to their groups about dealing with aging parents, dealing with second generation Holocaust issues. And I've also become an expert on how one should not retire, but one should rewire. In other words, you don't just sit at home in a hammock or play golf, but you should do something that you've always wanted to do and never had the time to do.
And again, your podcast is Spirits and Spirituality, and how often does that come out?
Every couple of weeks. Now, like I said, I think there's been 12 episodes from the first season, and now we're on to our third, just finished our third episode for the second season.
And people can also find information and links for that on your website at talkradiotommy.com, correct?
Yes, talkradiotommy.com. You can find all the podcasts, and you can find the samples of the memoir.
Tommy, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for being on the program with us.
Great. Thank you for having me. An honor.
Broadcaster and author Tommy Schnurmacher. As mentioned, his book, Mom's Makeup Tips from Auschwitz, How Vanity Saved My Mother's Life, will be coming out later this year. And you can read some of the early chapters now by going to his website at talkradiotommy.com. And you can also catch his podcast called Spirits and Spirituality by going to his site. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0516, and you'll find links to Tommy's site.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook.
There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Saving Our Endangered Seabirds. Plus, we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way. And we have a few more Stuff File news stories here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A man was arrested for a hit-and-run crash involving some Hollywood-level elements. Lee County deputies in Florida arrested 35-year-old Robert Foley. Deputies say he crashed into an abandoned truck in Lehigh Acres and then ran off. Based on tire marks, deputies say Foley was driving westbound on 21st Street toward a large ditch. That was when an arrest report shows, based on the physical evidence, it was apparent the Nissan Versa was traveling at such a great speed that it vaulted airborne and cleared a water canal ditch in a fashion only to be described similar to what was depicted in the Dukes of Hazzard. From there, deputies say the car kept going until it smashed into a parked truck. Helicopters were used to search for Foley after the crash. When deputies found him, they say he appeared to be in pain and smelled of alcohol. He was taken to the hospital before being booked into the Lee County Jail. You know, there are just too many people, usually in the South, who thought The Dukes of Hazzard was a documentary. That's all I'm saying. Nothing else. Draw your own conclusions. An Uber driver who pulled over for some me time ended up getting into a tussle with Monroe, Connecticut police officers. 48-year-old Elliot Buonanno Andrade of West Haven was charged with interfering with police and driving under the influence. Police said officers were dispatched for a suspicious vehicle, and they found a white BMW sedan parked on the side of the road with the windows fogged up. Police said that when officers approached the car, they saw Elliot reclined and enjoying the pleasure of his own company in the driver's seat. When an officer knocked on the car window, Elliot appeared confused and started to pull his pants up. The cop asked him what he was doing, to which he replied, "I work for Uber." Police said there was an open case of beer on the passenger side floor of the car. When Elliot was asked to recite the alphabet, police said he started at D and ended at K. Ordered from the car, Elliot got out and began reaching into his pants. Fearing he had a weapon, police said they struggled with him before bringing him to the ground. Elliot began yelling that the object he was reaching for was a sex toy, which he then pulled out of his underwear. Well, someone's not getting a good Uber review. Just saying. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Artist Lynn Matsuoka is back on the program. We had her on last year talking about her days as a courtroom artist during the Watergate hearings. Well, Lynn is back because she has a new adult coloring book with original drawings of endangered seabirds. It's called Saving Our Endangered Seabirds, and it has been endorsed by the Audubon Society. Lynn joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. This, I guess, is a topic that is near and dear to your heart. How did you come up with this idea of writing and creating this comic book, Saving Our Endangered Seabirds?
Okay, first, I really don't want to correct you, but I must correct you. It is not a comic book. So I'm glad you said that so I can clarify it, you know, completely.
Did I say comic book? I meant coloring book.
Yes, it's a coloring book. I mean, but see, this is a normal jump from coloring book to comic book because in most people's minds, that's what they see. And it's a good thing you said that because I'd really like to clarify that. It's a good point. The adult coloring books these days are trending. They're all over the place. And everybody who has a magic marker and can trace a mandala is putting out a coloring book. And I admit to the world up front, I'm a snob about three things, coffee, sushi, and art. And a lot of the art I see in these so-called coloring books are, I think, you know, abysmal. Okay, I'm saying that. So hate me. But my thing is drawing. It's what's gotten me down the pike and kept my kids in the best schools my entire career. So I'm using my drawing skills and what I did was I partnered up with Audubon's Project Puffin, whose mission in the world is to reclaim the seabirds and their habitats, which, by the way, will help us humans survive. And this is the whole point of the book. I think a lot of people know that the coloring books help you de-stress and separate you from the gerbil wheel you're on every day. And that my book affords you. But the major thing about this book is I have some wonderful guest pages where people like Susan Rockefeller and other PhDs and doctors of science have written very moving and informative messages about how climate change is affecting us and that we have to get off our duff and do something now. So I think there's something for everybody in this book and hopefully for people who want to become more aware. Now, to answer your question more specifically, some years ago I heard that because of climate change, and there are people who dispute this, but this is what I've heard from the scientists and read and everything, the seas have warmed up 1.5 degrees off the coast of northern Norway. As a result, let me back up. The puffins who live there, and most puffins, they depend on catching these slim little fish because those are the only things they can feed their pufflings, which are their baby chicks. They're the only things those little birds can, the baby birds can eat. So they dive into the water and they pick up mouthfuls of these fish and they feed it to their birds, their baby birds. But because of the sea warming up, the plankton that these slim fish feed on have either died out or gone to way deeper depths, you know, and it's difficult or impossible for the puffins to find the food for their pufflings, and as a result, masses of puffins have been dying out. The baby chicks have been starving and dying, and the puffins, not being stupid, stop laying eggs because they know that the babies aren't going to survive. And this is, so tragic, and this is happening all around the world in different places with different birds, and it's going to be happening with us if we don't watch it. So that's what kickstarted my idea to do something. And there are a few things I've been doing, but this book is the first thing that I have out in public. So I've always been passionate about birds. If it has feathers, I love it. I don't care if it's a pterodactyl. Anyway, so I finally got this together. I got great guest pages and people who are knowledgeable, because I'm no scientist. And I did, for this first edition, I've done 15 very carefully drawn images of endangered birds, and I got the list of these birds from the executive director of Project Puffin, who is a scientist, as you would describe himself. He's a bird scientist, and he knows the birds, so he gave me a list. I did the birds from that list, and I like to draw very fast and have very, quick, accurate drawings, whether they're people or birds or horses. But for these, I had to kind of draw a bird map, because, you want to color this, so I had to delineate the markings on the face and the feathers on the wings. But I tried to keep it a little bit open so it's not oppressively detailed. And I used the Japanese water patterns for the seascapes behind them to make it a little bit different and special. So we have 15 drawings, and my hope is this. Am I talking too much? I hope not. My hope is this, that, you know, seabirds live at sea very far away. Most people never see a seabird, really. I'm hoping to bring them closer to us, create some kind of connection, even an emotional connection to the drawings and coloring of the drawings and focusing on the drawings. And then when you read the messages from these people who talk about what's going on, you feel more for what's going on because you've had this connection with the birds. So that's pretty much the story.
Quick question, and that is, as you say, a lot of people don't know these birds. A lot of people haven't seen these birds. So yeah. How would they know what color to color these birds?
Well, this is a very good question. Now, I'm doing this book on Amazon. I'd like to do private publishing, so I'll be looking for people who want to buy, like companies or organizations who want to buy, make a volume purchase. So if they purchase 10,000-20,000 books because they want it for their own purposes, then with that money, I can go to a publisher I've lined up who can do a custom publishing, and I can put color inside the book. So I can have pictures of these birds in the book. But for the Amazon publication that's coming out about maybe the, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, I don't know, of July, it's up to Amazon, I'm going to have on my website a number of things. One, to answer your question, I'm going to have a thumbnail photo of each bird so you can see the actual colors of the bird, but I want everybody to be free to do what they want with the bird. Putting an orange sky, making feathers purple, that's up to you. It's whatever you want to do, but you'll be able to see the bird on the website. It'll be announced on the front page. Go here to see the birds. I have a technique page in the book to suggest to people who aren't used to this kind of thing ways they can play with the coloring of the images. But sometime, I would say by the end of July, I should have a video up on the website with a technique video where you can actually see various ways to inspire you to approach the coloring. And, of course, people can go to the website for other information, for education, dates, for book signings, and for special offers.
With the book, I mean, obviously it's an important issue. It's about climate change. It's a serious message. It's a therapeutic situation because it is a coloring book for adults. But besides that, there is a portion of the proceeds that's going to the Audubon Project Puffin. So tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, thank you for bringing that up. A disclaimer that I must share. Project Puffin, Audubon Project Puffin, they have been so supportive and so good with their direction. Dr. Stephen Kress, he is Project Puffin, along with a lot of other people, he wrote the blurbs for the bird. He wrote an introduction to the book. So I was going to put on the cover, this book is endorsed by Audubon Project Puffin, and 15% of all my proceeds go to Project Puffin. But because this is technical, because our licensing agreement, and I'm giving them money, so why I have to sign an agreement, I don't know, but I'll sign it. But we haven't gotten it in place, so I am not allowed to mention that on the book. I probably shouldn't be even saying it here. But, oh well. Yes, I'm giving 15% of all proceeds. That means, when Amazon sells it, they're going to give me some tiny little, throw me a little bone, and 15% of whatever they throw at me will go to Project Puffin. But I'm also going to do book signings and other things, and no matter where this book sells, 15% of proceeds after expenses, meaning after the bookstore takes its percentage or Amazon takes theirs, whatever I get, I'm giving 15%. And that means if a company or an organization comes in and wants to buy a large quantity of books to give as gifts or make people aware or for their nonprofits they want to support, whatever it is, whatever money comes in, whatever is not necessary for basic out-of-pocket expenses, 15% goes to Audubon Project Fund.
And you mentioned the website earlier that people can find that information about it. Your website, once again, is?
So it's simply hamptonsartist.com. But it's Hamptons, H-A-M-P-T-O-N-S-A-R-T-I-S-T.com.
Thank you once again for being on the program with us.
thank you so much for helping me get the word out about this very important issue.
Artist Lynn Matsuoka. Her new adult coloring book is Saving Our Endangered Seabirds. For more information on the work she's doing and on her book, you can visit her website at hamptonsartist.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this program, which is show number 0516, and you'll find links to her site, plus either links to amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A would-be thief has been forced to pull down his pants and reveal his stolen spaghetti after it quickly started burning his leg. Video of the attempted theft was posted to the Facebook page of a Forest Road Fresh supermarket in Perth, Australia, where the thief was mocked by the shop owners. The footage shows a young man walking in the hot food aisle, where he quickly settles on a small aluminum foil container of hot pasta for his lunch. In the full view of a customer browsing the aisle next to him, he opens the waist of his trousers and slides it down his pant leg. Quickly realizing the heat of the situation, he starts walking towards the registers, but his stride quickly turns into a fast limp as the temperature becomes too much to handle. Now, in quite a lot of pain, he reaches into his pants, but the container has come apart in his trousers as the young man flings out the pasta lid in vain. The shoplifter heads straight for the door, leaving a trail of spaghetti behind him. Needless to say, the spaghetti is gone, but the meatballs are extremely tender. Now, why, oh why, would you think that the best way to steal a hot meal from a supermarket is to put it down the front of your pants? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0516. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0516. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.